Hi, welcome to O'Reilly Radar. I'm Jim Stogdill. This week, Mike Lukides joins John Bruner and I as we talk about software and the physical world. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And I'm not drinking coffee.
And Mike's drinking tea. I'm drinking coffee. I don't know about John this morning.
We're not doing this one face to face because I'm not a lazy castabout who is still, you know, trying to wake up at 9:15 in the morning.
Yeah, Mike started this conversation prior to starting recording, telling us that he wasn't quite awake yet. So we're going to see how lively we can get him. We're going to talk about. We're going to start off talking about some work we've been doing around sort of the real world and see where the conversation goes. We've been contemplating a lot this notion that software developers are beginning to exit the virtual space and see what impact they can make on the real world again, everything from 3D printers to the industrial internet stuff that John's been covering, robotics, et cetera. Software developers are kind of re-entering the world of physical things again.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the Other Mill Kickstarter project that Saul Griffith's lab has started.
So is that thing both a CNC machine and additive, or is it subtractive only?
No, it's subtractive only. It's just a CNC machine. But what it looks to me like is that it puts CNC machines on the same kind of price curve that we saw in 3D printers, and I think that's revolutionary.
What are people going to do with them, do you think, Mike?
This particular one is designed for milling printed circuit boards, which is sort of an alternative technique for making a printed circuit board that doesn't require nasty acids and stuff to etch the copper. I don't think that's where we're going to end up long term, though. I think that if you want to build interesting stuff, you need both the ability to, you know, do additive making with a 3D printer, and you need to be able to cut things out.
Right.
So this sort of makes the whole suite, and it's all, you know, it's all computer controlled. And the real interesting issue is going to be how well it works. At OrdCamp in Chicago, a lot of people had small, hacker style home 3D printer style milling machines, and my impression was that they spent all of the time trying to get them to work. Saul will really have something on his hands if they can get over that hurdle.
Is your sense that that the additive process using the sintering method for metallic 3D printing is on its way to accessibility for home users?
I mean, I don't know enough about that. I was talking to somebody who said that he could get that down to... He thought that the prices on that would drop down to $10,000 or so.
Uh-huh. But that seems like that's the... that's a big part of the reason that you really need a milling machine and a 3D printer. As long as 3D printers are using plastic additive processes, there are things that you'll need to make out of metal or out of higher impact plastics that you'd still need to make with a milling machine rather than a 3D printer.
I think that's it. I mean, if we have if you can get a powdered metal printer down to $500 or even $2,000, then that's another real game changer. But I think with sort of, mechanical constraints, I think that's going to be a lot harder to do. Mm-hmm. I even think Ten is probably pushing it, although I have to be honest and say they don't know what they cost now.
Mm-hmm. I think they're still only useful at the industrial level, but they're extremely promising at the industrial level. Talk about the next step in the automated factory. You can use those metallic 3D printers to print working mechanical components. And you can print a hinge that's functional the minute you take it out of the machine, and that requires no assembly whatsoever. You just print it as a working hinge with multiple components.
Yeah,
really, with the pin in it as a separate component?
That's right, yeah.
Well, That's
yeah, and sometime within the past year and a half, I was on a flight and read an article about using powdered metal sintering printers to build jet engine components, and not just the easy stuff like, you know, housings, the you know, the turbine blades.
Yeah, GE says really that they're scary. Planning to do that within the next year or two. Start using 3D printing to build components in the manufacturing process, not just prototyping, where they're using it already in prototyping. But you can imagine that it really changes the type of mechanical component that you can make, because they don't have to be assemblable. You know, if you're building a hinge in a way that requires human assembly, then you have to design separate parts that can be assembled. But if you're just 3D printing it from the start, you don't have that design constraint. You don't have to have the parts be able to, you know, fit together from separate parts into a whole. You can design something in a way that's impossible to take apart. Probably it can be much more robust in that way.
Well, one hopes. Actually, we've all had experience with things that were designed so that they were impossible to take apart, and it's usually that's fine until something breaks and you need to fix it.
That's totally right.
Part of the promise of things being so cheap to manufacture, though, is that you no longer need to fix them. I mean, when's the last time you fixed a piece of audio equipment? I at one point I took in a piece of stereo equipment I had that I wanted to have repaired, and as is typically the case now, it was more expensive to repair it than it would have been to buy a new one. Just because there's so little labor in the assembly that just a little bit of labor and repair overwhelms it.
Yeah, you know, the hallmark of the blighted American downtown is that fading sign over a storefront that says Westinghouse Televisions repaired here.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Well, what in the end, what do you think is more impactful in this world, though? The idea that things like 3D printers and milling machines are, you know, become the laser printer of 3D from a price point of view? Or is it the ecosystem of, you know, electronic supplies and et cetera overseas that you can now get access to easily through sites like Alibaba and others? I mean, you know, there's all kinds of places where sort of the hurdle is going down for interacting with physical components.
Yeah, and that's why we've started to talk about this entire area as one area worthy of, you know, investigation and development on our part. You know, the accessibility goes all the way from how you acquire the components to how you build the components to how you interact with them from software into the physical world. You know, part of your question there about sourcing the components on Alibaba raises another interesting question, which is, you know, what's the future of expertise in a world where everything is totally accessible to everyone? I mean, you know, in theory, the economic theory, you know, of comparative advantage and so forth suggests that, you know, a company that's very good at producing a certain kind of gear is always going to produce that gear at better quality and lower price than you'd be able to do yourself. But does, you know, 3D printing and accessible CNC milling change that? You know, where will the balance emerge between everyone produces everything custom made and one off, and everyone orders compellingly priced and easy to find products from factories that specialize in things?
Well, actually, that's an interesting idea. I mean, this could be the end of standardized parts, couldn't it? You know, I mean, I don't need a 440 screw if I can 3D print my own screw, whatever crazy thread specifications I want.
Right.
And I was thinking something different. One of the things that I do as a hobby is ham radio, and I've done a fair amount of antenna work and, you know, antenna design and antenna modeling, which is all simulated. And one of the things that's interesting there is genetic algorithms, actually. you sort of sketch out something that is not going to work, and then an algorithm keeps on modifying it, looking when it's getting better and improving it, and you end up with some kind of result. It just occurred to me, since we're talking about the intersection of software and the physical world, you can do that for parts now. I mean, you could do that for, if you're in the, if you're in this weird state where, you need a screw and one size is too big, the next smaller size you're not sure is strong enough, you could actually conceivably go to some software that's generating CAD/CAM files and say, hey, optimize this. I don't even know if such optimizers exist, but in principle, they're not terribly hard.
They do in some forms. Mm-hmm. Someone was showing me a metal 3D printed part that was two sheets of metal with sort of a skeletal structure inside. This is a heat sink kind of component, and they said that they had the skeletal structure was designed completely by software. It looked very organic. It sort of looked like a forest with tree trunks growing at slightly different angles and irregularly placed between these two bits of metal. And the guy said that all he had to do was specify the sort of structural parameters of the piece, and the software generated the actual structure of the skeleton automatically in the course of printing it.
Oh yeah, actually, and I in terms of applications, yeah, heat sinks are an obvious application for that kind of optimization. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think there's, once we start getting into this, there's going to be a lot more.
Right. So this raises interesting questions about what standardization and parts will look like. If we get to a place where a lot of mechanical components, a lot of high-end physical devices are being designed or manufactured by people without much of a background in mechanical engineering or industrial engineering, I think a mechanical engineer would just naturally say, oh well, we'll use a 440 screw, in this location, that's a standard screw, we can get it. Even if we're fabricating it ourselves, it makes sense to use standardized parts for a handful of reasons. But I am not a mechanical engineer. I'm not entirely sure what a 440 screw is. And if I had a CNC milling machine on my desk along with a couple of good 3D printers and I decided to prototype something, I'm not sure that I would incorporate a lot of the sort of standardized mechanical features that a mechanical engineer would naturally include. Things might start to look sort of different. It could be, as you say, the end of standardization in that sense.
Yeah, I kind of doubt it. I think that, I suspect it may be the end of, I imagine we'll find some surprising design choices, both from this perspective of people, designing things without sort of the heritage of that background, but also to Mike's point, which was super interesting about incorporating genetic algorithms that sort of understand the underlying physics that an engineer would have been trained to deal with. That's kind of cool. I think, though, that for things like fasteners and all kinds of other things that we typically think of as the standard components, I can't imagine a lot of that going away, because just if nothing else, it's still going to be cheaper and easier to order a bunch of those things from Fastenal than it will be to print them out yourself. At least I would suspect for a long time that would be true.
Well, certainly in production, I bet that is. If you look at the mailing lists for people who are affiliated with NYC Resistor, the hardware lab here in New York, for instance, people are always sort of complaining about having ordered a particular cog or something from an online warehouse that stocks tens of thousands of cog designs. And, they're so specific. It's so hard to do mechanical engineering at a small scale level in your basement shop by ordering mechanical parts from a warehouse and waiting 2 days for them to get there. And then you immediately put the two pieces together and find that they don't fit, or that they don't fit the way that you want them to. So, you know, I think fabrication will be the standard way to do prototyping. So the question is how will standardization come into play with prototyping? Maybe you know, Fastenal will make 3D printed CAD files. Maybe Fastenal will make 3D printer CAD files available for all of its parts, and then you can do your prototyping at home, and then order 10,000 on the cheap from them when you're ready to go into production.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
Well, that is an interesting thought, because we tend to think about the prototyping and, you know, the home entrepreneur, but at some point, if you're successful, you need to make 10,000 of the things, and 3D printers and milling machines aren't really fast, and they run really great in parallel, but even if they're $500 a piece, they're not. A home entrepreneur isn't going to be able to invest in 1,000 of them.
Right.
Yeah, I just like I'm back on the idea of, it was sort of a radical thing back in the day when Amazon, put so much data into their online catalog, made it available. It seems like if you're providing products to industrials in the future, or even sort of home industrial, is publishing your CAD file as part of your catalog going to be kind of mandatory? That's an interesting thought on how to sort of jump the gun and get that audience interested in what you're able to do for them.
And it's a good way to assert the value of what you're doing, right? I mean, it's publishing CAD files for your products is something you only do if you're really certain that you are providing the best value in producing these fasteners. And I bet you are. I mean, even the best, industrial 3D printers are not going to produce a fastener as effectively as a giant fastener factory that's machining them on a specialized piece of equipment.
Not even close.
The
economics of one screw per minute probably don't match up with what's coming out of
exactly. Factory. So it'd be a way for them to make the same kind of assertion that Amazon makes in their price check app. There's always a possibility that when you're standing inside Best Buy and you scan something, you'll discover that Best Buy has a better price than Amazon. But Amazon is pretty certain of its guarantee, and they're happy to have people carry around this app to prove themselves. In the same way, releasing CAD files for your products is a way of saying, we are really certain that this is where you're going to end up buying.
The other day, I sat down with Kip Bradford, Alistair Allen, and Julie Steele, and went over some of what they're doing with the data sensing lab. And I don't know if you guys know this, but they're getting ready to put the data sensing lab components into the Google I/O show next week, or I guess later this week, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting example, I think, of some of the things we've been talking about as software and hardware come together. So the last little bit of conversation was sort of about impact on manufacturing, drawing the parallel between the cost of those components coming down, much like laser printers did before, and that created the desktop publishing industry. And so maybe those similar kinds of dynamics will unfold in hardware. But the data sensing lab is interesting because what they're doing is putting sensors all over the conference venue that detect everything from whether or not people are talking to whether or not there's somebody moving in the area, et cetera. And, we did this at the Strata conference for O'Reilly back in Santa Clara. And I think we had something on the order of 75 of these data sensing moats that were mesh networked together and sending data back to some real-time analysis. But at I/O, they're rolling out, I think, over 500 of them. So it's significantly bigger scale. And, from development of the idea to rolling out these moats, they're different this time. They have a different form factor, some slightly different electronics in them. That process was really short, and not just short in terms of designing and taking advantage of things like Arduinos to be able to put it together rapidly, but also very short in how rapidly they were able to receive the parts and essentially do light manufacturing to build these things out. I think there's sort of a notion of what's to come and what they were able to do in 3 or 4 weeks.
Absolutely. It's large scale manufacturing available now in small scale. I mean, they're taking advantage of the kinds of manufacturing techniques that just 5 or 10 years ago you'd have had to apply to a minimum order of 10,000 devices in a factory in Taiwan or something. But KIPP was able to order 300 of these things from a factory that I don't want to make up the number for what he told me, but KIPP said something to me that was really remarkable about the number of components that the machine at this factory can place on a printed circuit board in 1 second. And I won't make up the number, but it was a lot. They're using extremely sophisticated fabrication tools to build these devices. And these tools only a few years ago were only available on a very large minimum order, 10,000 devices out of a factory in Taiwan or something. But now it's possible to order just 300 of them. A prototype arrives, in your mailbox 2 days after you send in the designs. It only costs $500 to prototype it, and then they can put it into production immediately.
Do you know which component that was? Because the brains of this thing's an Arduino. What other components did they have to develop? Or did they actually develop something in hardware for this?
I believe they did. I believe they had the printed circuit board manufactured for this that the sensors are mounted on, rather than soldering that together themselves.
And the next step of optimization, which I don't think they've done in this version, is to actually build your own Arduino rather than buying pre-assembled Arduinos and putting the Arduino itself onto one board. So there's just one board for the whole thing.
Yeah, they haven't done that. They also the other area where they did run into some sort of old school difficulty was that they didn't have enough time or quantity to have the manufacturer load the programs into the board. So they had to do some of the assembly and then also do the programming, which turned out to be the slowest part of the whole process, actually downloading the program into every Arduino.
Sounds like
there were a lot of 3 a.m. nights getting the code into those 500 Arduinos.
Well, that sounds a lot like the introduction of the Fitbit, which is a great example of sort of the slow transition to the kind of manufacturing that we're talking about. When the Fitbit came out a few years ago, it was much anticipated. They had tons of pre-orders for it, and it was delayed a lot before it came out. And if you go back and read about what the delays were, there were all sorts of things that were structural problems in the way that devices are manufactured that are sort of being fixed as part of this process. So, they had to get a ton of pre-orders in order to put in the minimum order to have these things made in a factory in China. And then when they did, the factory was too inflexible to be able to apply the firmware updates that they developed after they submitted the designs, but before they had finalized the software. And so you can find these blog posts that the Fitbit team published that show, pallets of Fitbits that have just been shipped to their office in California from the factory in China. And the entire Fitbit team is like staying in all night, unpacking every Fitbit, plugging it into a computer, reloading the firmware, and then putting it back in the box and packing it back up.
Yeah, that sounds insane. And that sounds like a lot of miserable late nights.
Yeah. But hopefully that's the sort of thing that this kind of more rapid response manufacturing, could fix. If your device is getting manufactured after just, a week, then you're not in the situation that Fitbit was in, where you're submitting your designs, and then 6 months later, the devices are arriving in your office, at which point the software has progressed.
Yeah, if you think about sort of how software has been developed in Silicon Valley for the last 5 or 10 years, and think about that in relation to what we're talking about with hardware, you know, there's a tendency to talk about the technology. Oh, look, you know, there's 3D printers, or there's, you know, Alibaba, you can buy all kinds of parts, or you can get them. Or there's an Arduino, which is open. You know, that's sort of where we tend to focus our attention, Arduinos and 3D printers. But the ecosystem that made Silicon Valley what it is much broader than just the technology. I mean, certainly open source software had a lot to do with how Silicon Valley has prospered. But it's also been about how the entire ecosystem works, right? Like the, you know, how the economics of it work, how you can, you know, there's a this concentration of talent in one place. The fact that DreamHost and then later EC2 meant that you didn't have to apply fixed cost to your business idea. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kinds of places where those hurdles came down. I think it's interesting to look at as software and hardware sort of become more connected again in that way. Some of what you're talking about, John, with the logistics stuff is kind of like those other things. You know, it's not just 3D printing and Arduinos. It's, can you get access to them? Are factories flexible enough to add, you know, logic to it later after it's already in production? How seamless are their interactions, et cetera?
Right. Right. You know, and a lot of this comes back to the sort of the idea that we've seen a lot on the software side of the sort of Internet of Things, industrial Internet movement, of, you know, decoupling the software design phase from the hardware design phase so that you can design the software very quickly prior to release so that it's very current, you know, when it comes out. This, in a way, is the same thing on the hardware side. I mean, you can now produce the hardware at the very last minute as well. And then it's current. You've gone through all of the design revisions that you can before it actually, you know, goes out.
Hey, Mike, are you still there?
Yeah,
did you drink
still
some
here.
Of your tea and wake up?
Yeah.
This all reminds me of a funny conversation I was having with some other people who were talking about the interesting Chinese industrial spam that they get through one of their mailing lists. And the person I was talking to was saying, you know, I get these emails all the time that are like, you know, we have an excellent price available now on railroad freight car wheels.
And it's
sort of like who, well, first of all, that's amazing. And you know, I would sort of enjoy ordering like one railroad freight car wheel from one of these places just to see what happens. You know, probably their margins are so thin, you can't order fewer than 10,000 of these, and they've lost money
really,
just
really
by
heavy.
Responding to your email. But
yeah, don't FedEx it.
Yeah, I used to get this spam from this place that was offering cold rolled steel in 20,000 pound rolls. I was like,
that's amazing. Yeah, you better ship that UPS ground.
Yeah,
dump that into your antenna design logic and see what comes out.
Yeah. But also, who is buying industrial components from spammers? You know, what factory, you know, floor manager or sort of industrial engineer is going, oh man,
we were gonna hire AT Kearney to source that, but what the hell? I got a spam this morning. We'll just buy them from them.
Exactly. Oh, they also sell pharmaceuticals. We can kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah, that's.
I wonder if any of these are like, you know, counterfeit railroad wheels, like the counterfeit pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine going to the trouble to counterfeit a wheel.
Oh, that's odd. I've never seen a tire on a train wheel before.
This should not be made out of tin.
Exactly. Didn't think these were wooden these days.
Well, the economics of these things get really pretty strange, though. I mean, I remember it was about 2 years ago, Tim brought a bunch of people to this a distillery that makes, you know, rum from cacao in Red Hook, Brooklyn, and it was amazing. They had the world's first, as far as they know, completely internet controlled still But they also, you know, they had this other machine there that I don't remember what it did, but they said, oh yeah, we had to, you know, this was something that they needed. We could have bought it from a company in Germany that makes these things for about $250,000, but we designed one and had it manufactured in China for about $16,000. And they shipped it here, and it was totally messed up. It was, it would not have worked. The, you know, they had, parts of it that were supposed to run on 24 volts were connected to 440 volt power sources and stuff like that. It was a complete disaster. So we went and fixed it, and the total cost of fixing it was probably somewhere around another $10,000. So it's like, even with a totally screwed up manufacturing process by some, by a really bogus vendor, they still came out ahead by a factor of about 90%. I mean, they spent about 10% of what it would have cost to buy something commercial that they knew would have been right in the first place.
Is that because they designed it in a way that had fewer bells and whistles, or was it just that the cost of manufacturing was, you know, two orders of magnitude lower?
My understanding was that it was just the difference in the cost of manufacturing. Now, since they designed their own, it's certainly possible that, yeah, they did. It's certainly possible they designed it without functionality that they didn't think they really needed, and that could, that probably did save them some.
See, it's an interesting, I think it's going to be interesting, you know, that when the advantage is low cost, and John mentioned the comparative advantage thing earlier, and sometimes comparative advantage is technology, we know how to do something, but if it's lower cost, that seems like it's changing a bit now, because not only are costs slowly beginning to level out for labor, but also more importantly probably is that the cost of energy goes up, the cost of shipping goes up. And so how that factors back into, you know, how people take advantage of these decreasing costs or, you know, localized manufacturing capability, I think will be really interesting.
Yeah, this is all saying a lot about the impact of this area on, you know, low volume, the low volume end of everything, right? We've already sort of agreed that at the high volume end, specialized manufacturers have a lot to offer in terms of low prices for standardized components. But at the low volume end, where the producers of something like a still have to charge an enormous margin on every product in order to recover their fixed costs and development costs, fabricating things on your own is going to, might offer an enormous value. You know, this is,
yeah, you know, I wonder
the
if
obscure
you know,
end, just like on the internet has made the obscure end of culture widely available at low cost, right? All of these sort of subgenres of interest have been able to find communities on the internet that never found communities before. And in the same way, I think physical devices that are very difficult to find or buy now are going to become much more widely available at low cost.
That's an interesting idea. What kind of weird fetishized devices are we going to find?
Well, there are all sorts of, in terms of weird fetishized devices that you can buy on the internet, have you ever come across the flashlight enthusiast community? People who buy these $1,000 flashlights that are, you know, so bright that they can light paper on fire from
I haven't come across that, but somebody once gave me a flashlight that was like $150, and the bulb burned out fairly quickly.
Someone gave me one of those.
Almost that much to replace.
What you were saying before made me think of another analogy, though, John. Like again, going back to Silicon Valley, one of the things we saw is sort of this separation between utility computing and then all the things people do with it, right? And so we have, you know, all kinds of possibility of what people do with computing, and then, but they all run essentially in the same place now, in, you know, contexts like EC2. And it almost makes me, you know, is there an equivalent of almost like utility manufacturing where, you know, there's chunks of things that are similar, or at least the process is similar. And so we can have this flowering of niche-like manufactured products, but that still live on some backbone of large-scale, low-cost, highly efficient manufacturing.
That's a really good question. Yeah, sort of what will, in the case of flashlights, for instance, these like incredibly expensive flashlights, a big part of every flashlight is just a couple of sort of milled tubes, right? You know, if standardized aluminum tubes, you know, become widely available, what will people be able to do with those? Or standardized, you know, high voltage, you know, circuitry of the sort that could go into a flashlight. Maybe this is the rebirth of standardized products. So, as the, you know, at the conclusion of this phone call, we'll have to decide whether standardization is doomed or whether this is the birth of a new era of the importance of standardization.
Or in what form will it take? I mean, even as I was asking the question, I was struggling to think about how that would work. I mean, in the case of your flashlight, it's probably the lighting source that is the standard part, and then the fetishization of it comes from, you know, everybody creating their own, you know, magnesium alloy or whatever enclosure for it.
Parabolic mirrors.
But yeah. I mean, if I have an idea and it relies on some specific implementation of something, then I guess, you know, the utility manufacturing may not come from the supply of standard parts that I would use. It may come from the ability to scale out rapidly if I want to, you know, deliver to a bigger audience than I expected or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot. It'd be interesting to watch how that plays out.
We'll include a link to one of these flashlights or a flashlight enthusiast community in the blog post that goes along with this podcast.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by the one that will set stuff on fire. I think that'd be fun to have in the office.
To be fair, you have to, I think you have to hold it pretty close to the thing that you're setting on fire, and also the battery is drained in, like, you know, 30 seconds of running this flashlight. So
I'm just imagining the next time the inevitable, you know, rubber band war breaks out, you know, pull that thing out of the backpack. What else, guys? Anything else come to mind that's top of mind in this topic area? You know, we're thinking through what we do in the space. And I think that the data sensing lab stuff is really interesting for us because it does bring together sort of the software hacker and hardware hacker things together. And also the other thing that was interesting about data sensing lab is that it was really about saying to data scientists that may not have a way to capture the data they're interested in, that there are really low-cost ways now to capture that data. I think maybe the biggest challenge for us on our end is trying to figure out, you know, how do you frame all these things together that sort of seem like they might be different, but that actually have a lot of similarity.
But the whole origin of Solid actually comes from looking at a whole bunch of things that sort of look different, everything from professional making to, you know, sensor networks to robotics, and saying, hey, there is really a common core here, and these things are all more similar than different. So, yeah.
Right. It's accessibility. I mean, this is this was the exciting thing for me about the industrial internet, and it's the exciting thing about this, these trends coming together in manufacturing too. It's easier than ever to interact with the physical world through software and through software interfaces. It's always been easy to learn software, and now that those kinds of structures are coming to the physical world, and they're coming to manufacturing as well.
Yeah. Next time we do this, we got to get together over actual coffee.
Yeah.
I think that I think the background noise of crashing plates adds something to the effect. But thanks, guys. I appreciate your time.
Of course,
thanks. We'll talk again soon.
Indeed.
Bye.
Bye.